From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in a coal plant. We're on an oil rig. Who's investing in this kind of energy? That answer has always been a complicated one. In recent years, you've probably heard calls for New York State to divest from fossil fuel companies. Those calls have been organized by youth climate leaders across New York State. But what does it really mean? Well, last week, New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli wrote an op-ed in the Times Union defending New York State's actions. He says they're among the most responsible and thoughtful of any government in the world. Comptroller DiNapoli writes, quote, "New York was the first state pension plan in the United States to develop and implement a comprehensive climate action plan to respond to this challenge. The plan follows the recommendations of the Decarbonization Advisory Panel that was convened by Governor Andrew Cuomo and myself." DiNapoli goes on to point out, for example, quote, "After a thorough assessment, the fund is divested from 22 thermal coal mining companies that are not prepared to thrive or even survive in the low-carbon economy. We are currently evaluating the low-carbon transition readiness of oil sands extraction companies, and we will follow that with assessments of other industries that are at high risk from climate change, including other companies in the energy, utility, and transportation sectors." And the comptroller concludes, quote, "I am committed to keeping the New York plan one of the best-funded retirement systems in the nation, and also one of the most responsible investors in the world," end quote. So we asked State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli to come back on Connections to discuss this issue and to engage with youth climate leaders who have been encouraging responsible and aggressive action. The comptroller will join us at 12:30. We look forward to welcoming him to the conversation. And before then, let's welcome a couple of youth climate leaders. Now, Radesh Singh and Liam Smith are back with us, and they are moving on in their life. I don't know if the titles I have for both of you are outdated or not. Radesh, I'm going to start with you, okay? I'm going to see if I've got it. You ready?
Yeah, go for it.
Board Secretary for the Rochester People's Climate Coalition, co-founder of the Brighton High School Climate Club in your past years, and membership of the leadership team for the Rochester Youth Climate Leaders. Close or not close?
Yeah, pretty close. And now I serve as executive director for the New York Youth Climate Leaders.
The New York Youth Climate Leaders. Liam Smith, I'm not even going to try. Why don't you introduce yourself, Liam?
Hi, yeah, I'm Liam. I also started the Climate Club at Brighton with Radesh, and I helped bring the Rochester Youth Climate Leaders off its feet. I serve as the co-director of government affairs for the New York Youth Climate Leaders.
Now, let me ask both of you where you've kind of gone in your lives in recent months. It's been sort of a strange few months here for high school seniors. Radesh, what's the pandemic been like for you, and where are you going next?
Yeah, definitely. It's been really surreal. You know, we're all kind of been in this together, you know, quarantining in our homes, making sure that we limit the spread of coronavirus. And the school transition has been definitely quite difficult to go to completely online learning. You know, Liam and I were both seniors. We lost a lot of, you know, the special senior memories that, you know, a lot of people cherish for the rest of their lives, like, you know, ball, graduation, bash, banquet, etc. So it was definitely a transition and adjustment, but it's still nice to, you know, reconnect and with everyone in our senior class digitally. And next up, I'm going to be attending Williams College in the fall on campus, which I'm very excited for.
What are you going to focus on?
That's a really good question. There's so many things to focus on. I'm leaning towards majoring in environmental studies and political science, but again, I'm not sure. I'm really excited to be on campus, to be with, you know, like-minded youth, and just really dive into my studies.
And Liam, what about you?
Yeah, I'll be attending Middlebury College in the fall. I haven't really decided what I'll major in. I'm interested in chemistry and econ, so we'll see how it goes.
Do you expect, Liam, and I'll ask both of you, do you expect that as you go throughout college that you will be similarly involved in climate issues and action, Liam?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to stay involved in climate advocacy and in college, and I'm definitely staying involved in New York State as well.
What about you, Radesh?
Evan, you know me, right?
Well, you know, busy people.
100%. You know, the struggle for climate justice and combating the climate crisis, it's a lifelong issue. It's a lifelong campaign. I'm going to continue to stay involved in New York State. I'm going to start, you know, organizing at Williams College in Massachusetts as well. So I'll always be involved in the climate movement pretty much for the rest of my life.
Well, I want both of you, if you could, to respond to some of the op-ed from Comptroller DiNapoli, who's going to join us in about 20 minutes, and we'll have a lot to talk about with him. He is making the case that when we look at New York State and government action regarding fossil fuels and climate, it's a complicated picture, and it's not just about divestment, but divestment does matter, and New York State has been careful in making sure that pensions, for example, aren't going in the direction that we don't want them to go. But he's trying to also paint a comprehensive picture that includes some action that we'll talk about with him when he's on the program. Radesh, what did you make of his op-ed?
Yeah, definitely. Well, first off, we want to give credit where credit is due. We thoroughly commend Comptroller DiNapoli's decision to divest from 22 coal companies. And we also fully acknowledge that he's taken some steps to address climate change. But unfortunately, these actions have simply not been enough in the face of this existential crisis, which is climate change. Now there's been recent reports coming out of a lot of climate analysis firms in Europe that the world is now on track to hit 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming by 2024, which coincidentally is the year which I'm set to graduate from college. So simply our generation and future generations to come cannot afford any further delay, which is why we're continuing to call on Comptroller DiNapoli to fully divest the Common Retirement Fund from the billions of dollars of assets they have in the fossil fuel industry.
Liam, what did you make of the op-ed?
Well, I recognize that Comptroller DiNapoli has done some positive things in the area of climate change. His commitment to invest billions of dollars in climate solutions and renewable companies has definitely been something that we appreciate in the climate movement. However, his failure to divest from oil stocks and tar sands and gas stocks really represents really overlooks the entire issue of climate change, which is you can't just focus on coal and you can't just focus on investing in renewable energy. You also have to stop investing in look at the companies that are having the most impact on climate change right now.
So let me read a little bit more of what the comptroller wrote. He says, New York's pension fund is recognized by independent observers as a leader among investors in responsibly addressing the risks and opportunities presented by climate change. The Asset Owners Disclosure Project ranks New York as number one nationally and number three globally among public pension funds that incorporate climate risk in investment decisions. And New York was the first state pension plan in the United States to develop and implement a comprehensive climate action plan to respond to this challenge, end quote. So, Radesh, anything that you dispute there? I mean, he is pointing out, some of the assessments that other groups have made. Anything you would dispute there?
Yeah, definitely. So, again, as Liam mentioned, we commend the comptroller on his decision to divest from coal. He has allocated billions of dollars into investments into clean energy as well. And I think that's a very important step for not only, our pension fund, but all public pension funds from across the nation to take. However, in his climate action plan, he says that divestment from any assets should only be done when, quote, there is an articulable, serious, and sustained financial risk to continuing the investment. And to this point, we completely agree, and which is why we continually call for divestment, because the fact that our public pension fund has billions of dollars invested in the fossil fuel industry, and the industry for the past 5 years has consistently underperformed the market average, resulting in immense losses for those who have stubbornly remained invested in this industry. We call on DiNapoli to divest precisely based on the reasons he outlined in his climate action plan.
Now, he's kind enough to take his time and come on the program, and he's going to engage in these conversations with us in just a few minutes here. Are you open to Radesh? I mean, as you go throughout this process of learning about investments and what divestment actually looks like, do you feel like you've got the full picture? Are you open to hearing his argument for why he has made certain decisions but not others?
Yeah, definitely. You always have to, have an open mind on these issues. As Liam and I were both, just students about to, undertake our freshman year in college. So by no means we're not experts on this issue. However, based on, multiple studies from a variety of different economists, climate scientists, climatologists, a variety of different other institutions, they've all called for divestment and have divested from the fossil fuel industry as this industry has continued to underperform market average after market average. And it doesn't take, you know, someone with a PhD in economics to see the writing on the wall and the fact that this industry is in rapid, rapid decline.
Okay. Liam, I don't think he would have come on this program if he's not serious about this issue. And I'm not trying to sort of soft pedal it or say that elected leaders shouldn't be asked significant and hard questions, and that's part of the job. But, you know, you have no problem, Liam, talking directly to people in power. You've done it in different settings, and we've talked about that on this program. Do you think he takes it seriously? Do you think he is serious about this issue?
I think that his divestment from coal shows that he is serious about this issue, and that he's feeling the pressure from groups like ours to divest. That said, I'm not convinced he's taken divesting oil and gas stocks seriously, because we haven't seen much of any movement on that end. And you know, I really look forward to talking with him on the program, because that's the really important next step to see. We have to divest from oil and gas. And we have to do it now.
I think it's
my generation.
Yeah, I hear that. I think it's really encouraging that he's coming on. I think it's encouraging that leaders will do that. And I salute the comptroller, and I'll tell him that on this program, because I think there's going to be some agreement and some appreciation, but also some disagreement, or at least some questions about why New York is doing certain actions but not others. And, you know, we certainly welcome that. We appreciate that. And listeners, again, the comptroller is going to come on at the half-hour mark of this program. We're talking on the line right now to a couple of New York youth climate leaders in Radesh Singh and Liam Smith, who've been working on these issues for a while. And Radesh and Liam are humble about this. I mean, you just heard Radesh say, you know, we're not experts. We're going to be freshmen in college. But I would put them in the category. I mean, we all know people who know just enough to be dangerous, but not really all that much, enough to give them a strong opinion without really knowing. These guys have done the work. They've really done the work, and I've seen a lot of adults over the years engage with people like Radesh and Liam and come away and feel sort of inspired or educated. So I think it's important, and I do look forward to the conversation. Now, I want to go back to what the comptroller wrote in his op-ed in the Times Union. Liam, he writes about not just divestment, but investment. Here's what he writes. Pursuant to our plan, I have doubled our commitment to sustainable investments to $20 billion, with an emphasis on climate solutions. I have appointed New York's first-ever director of sustainable investments and climate solutions, an investment professional with extensive experience in the area, who has already shepherded more than $1 billion in sustainable investments in his first 6 months on the job. End quote. Does that move you? Is that important?
Yeah, that is definitely important and a good step in the right direction. We definitely need to be, you know, funding renewable energy and clean energy projects. But I really want to emphasize that is not enough. Divestment is a time-proven tool used to stigmatize morally reprehensible business practices. It was famously successful in the 1980s when across the world, people divested from apartheid in South Africa. And that was, you know, tremendously successful in, you know, attacking the, you know, the region's social license to operate. And we need to see the same thing happen with the fossil fuel industry. So we really appreciate the work that the comptroller has done so far, but we also recognize that there is more work to be done.
Okay. Radesh?
Yeah. Just would like to, you know, kind of relate this to an analogy that, you know, we often use in our discussions on climate, that say, you know, if you're driving, heading off a cliff, you're going about 60 miles an hour heading off a cliff, and, you know, you slow it down to about 40 miles per hour. Hey, that's an improvement, but you're still heading off a cliff, right? And the climate crisis is kind of similar in that, because we know that this crisis is imminent. It's already having real-world effects today. You saw just a week ago that the Arctic Circle hit almost 100 degrees Fahrenheit. You're seeing, you know, temperatures and events that we didn't think were going to happen for another couple decades, happening now and in the next couple of years. So even though you might have slowed the car down, we need to completely stop this crisis and stop this car from heading off the cliff. Otherwise, as Liam said, it's our generation and future generations to come that will be affected by the decisions made by the elected leaders today.
Before we welcome the controller in, I want to talk to both of you about what I thought was a really interesting conversation with the Nature Conservancy yesterday about a new survey they did. Their numbers from a survey of New Yorkers indicates a desire for permanent change post-pandemic. And I admit, before I talked to Jim Howe yesterday about that survey, I was a little caught up in kind of pandemic fatigue. I was one of those people back in March who was like, oh, here's a crisis. We're going to have common action. We're going to unite around this. It won't be the culture wars can't touch a virus. Come on. Which, of course, you know, how naive am I? I also thought, you know, we're going to see that we can move quickly to act if we perceive an emergency and a direct threat. And then we're going to relate it to climate change when the pandemic is over or even before, because we'll see the urgency and we'll see what we're capable of. And then I started to feel that malaise, that pandemic fatigue that everybody sort of feels like. And I kind of wondered if change is kind of within grasp. And the survey from the Nature Conservancy found that, man, New Yorkers in large numbers across political boundaries do want some permanent changes. And some of this stuff is really granular and I think pretty cool, you know, from changing the way cities are set up to, you know, closing down streets to car traffic and being more open to, you know, just walkable streets and putting restaurant seating right out in the middle of the street or playgrounds in the middle of the street, more pedestrian space, more green space, less focus on the automobile. I mean, that's great during a pandemic, and frankly, it's vital, and I'm a little surprised we haven't seen more of that. But people like that. They want more of that, not just because it's cool or it's helpful for restaurants, but because I think that they're seeing the way we've set up cities is pretty car-centric. It's pretty fossil fuel-centric. So that's one of the granular ones. 75% of New Yorkers want that, even post-pandemic. They want more streets shut down to cars and opened up to all kinds of businesses right out in the middle, outdoor seating, outdoor activity. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And then when it comes to the way New York State invests, a large majority do want an emphasis on everything from changing infrastructure to changing green space and access to protecting lands. It's strong numbers. It cuts across boundaries. Radesh, let me start with you. What have you learned during this pandemic? And I know you are an optimist. I know you what pretty well. But do you think that there is something that will be taken out of this going forward, whether it's in that small, granular way or the big ways coming out of this?
That's a really good question. At least personally, I've reflected a lot about, you know, what the effects of the coronavirus pandemic will be on not only the climate movement, but also, you know, the climate crisis, but also how we might, you know, use this pandemic to further address, you know, the other crises facing, you know, our nation, whether that be, you know, the housing crisis with, you know, millions of people potentially, you know, being evicted from their households throughout the month of July, you know, to the, you know, racial justice crisis that we have right now with, you know, Black and brown Americans being disproportionately affected by a variety of different issues. The solidarity and the togetherness that has cropped up in a lot of places as a result of the pandemic has made me hopeful in that regard, especially as you mentioned, you know, the increasing importance of listening to experts and scientists. And, you know, the scientists tell us that we need to drastically cut our emissions and drastically change our lifestyle to be less carbon centric. That has definitely made me hopeful. However, I think there's still a lot of, you know, variables that are related to this issue, because obviously, you know, it's a very complex issue. But I think the most important thing coming out of this pandemic has shown that if you have like the political will to do something, and if the political climate is right, you can do anything, and you can really create lasting change that will have its reverberating effects across generations.
Yeah, you know, the trust in science, Radesh, were you surprised at that? That was interesting to me. 2-1, New Yorkers say they have more trust in science as opposed to the same or less since March, since the pandemic began. More trust in science. Were you surprised by that, Radesh?
I guess maybe, but the thing is, you know, believing in climate science is one thing, And it's a really important step. But, you know, the real obstacle for true change when it comes to combating the climate crisis, they're not, you know, climate, like, you know, small-time climate deniers. It's really just the utter government inaction when it comes to this crisis and the lack of political will among many of our elected leaders when it comes to combating climate change. Because, you know, a lot of individuals, they say, you know, like, oh, you know, I believe in climate change, or, you know, we need to take environmental action now. But when it comes to, you know, specific actions to, you know, create a Green New Deal or invest in public infrastructure and renewable energy projects, then there isn't really much talk or support for that. So, you know, they say, you know, talk is cheap, action speaks louder than words. So I'm hoping that this, you know, increased trust in science results in political action. But, you know, it's up to us as advocates, activists, to, you know, translate that into concrete action.
Yeah, and I think maybe that increase in trust in science, maybe our communication during the pandemic is getting better, because I read a really smart scientist yesterday who was saying that that when it comes to understanding the scientific method, a lot of people who are not scientists are not trained in it, so they don't understand that things change and new information will recalibrate what our expectations and beliefs are based around those facts. And instead, when you hear, you know, you don't need to wear a mask, and then you hear, yes, you do need to wear a mask, people go, well, these people don't know what they're talking about, as opposed to saying, oh, they're getting new information. There's new data. That's exactly what happens. But I think there's been real movement there. Let's do this. Let's take our only break of the hour. And when we come back, we're going to welcome in Comptroller Tom DiNapoli, joining the New York youth climate leaders Liam Smith and Radesh Singh right here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, internet access is a civil right? The New York Times says this fall it is, because every day more school districts decide that students are not going to go back to the classroom in the fall, or are going to go back in a hybrid way. I mean, some in the classroom, some online. We know that online learning will be a vital component. So what does it mean when more companies are asking to increase data caps? We'll talk about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You've been hearing Radesh Singh and Liam Smith, who are New York youth climate leaders, and they've been working in various capacities for years now. And they're going to be college freshmen. That's a lot of work before turning 19 years old. The New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli is on the line with us now, talking about what New York State has been doing regarding climate action. And Mr. Comptroller, thank you for making the time for the program. How are you?
Evan, I'm well. It's nice to be back with you, and I hope you and your listeners are all safe and well during this continued time of great challenge with the pandemic.
This has been a grind, and there's a long road ahead here. But you know, certainly our state is in a better position than most at this point, and I think that is attributed to pretty good communication and a lot of work by a lot of people.
And fortunately, you know, with the strong messages that Governor Cuomo has put out there, people, by and large, have been listening and paying attention and wearing masks and doing social distancing. And clearly that's made a big difference. And you see in those states that aren't following those common sense guidelines, you know, they're unfortunately paying the price right now.
Before we get into climate action, just on the subject, since we brought it up here, Mr. Comptroller, you know, so it's been really interesting is the wrong word, because that makes it look like a parlor game, and this is a very, very serious crisis, and people are dying. So, it has been sort of, I guess, sort of in a way interesting to watch the way Governor Cuomo and state government's action has been perceived in this state and outside of this state, because, you know, certainly early on, no surprise, New York City was the hub of the crisis. It's an international city. It's super dense. The virus was probably seeding for weeks before we understood what was actually happening there. So no surprise that that would be the biggest outbreak and the hotspot, well before there's testing and tracing, well before we had a better handle on how to treat it and what to do about it. So none of that is a surprise. It's a tragedy. It certainly is what it is. But then, you know, we had April, May, and the governor was widely praised for his daily news conferences, clear communication, the actions New York State took, the actions that citizens have taken. Then I think as June hit, and we didn't really see a whole lot of case spread in other states, at least not at high levels, there was this idea that, well, New York State's response was too draconian, or it wasn't fast enough, and look at all these other states, and they're doing fine. And now, again, you've got this case where we are seeing massive case numbers in Florida, Texas, Arizona, California, Missouri, Georgia, and Unfortunately, we're seeing what a lot of epidemiologists predicted in those states. And now you've got people, I've got colleagues in other states saying, yeah, our governor doesn't do daily news conferences. We don't do daily communications on it. We don't have the kind of daily dashboard. So there's a lot of sort of fumbling around, kind of wondering what should be done here. How do you see that trajectory? And Mr. Comptroller, how do you see the role of government when it comes to, you know, not wanting to exercise too much power or control, but trying to do what is necessary to move the needle of public action?
It's, you know, it's certainly a balancing act, but I think what the key point, what you just went through, is that issue of communication. And I think, you know, where our governor gets very high marks is that he tackled it head on from the beginning. This is what we know. This is what the data and the science is telling us. This is what you need to do in your local communities. And I think, you know, by and large, people have responded. Has everybody been happy with it? No. Has everybody been doing what they need to do? No. And even in our own state, you've seen the stories, you know, of late with the nicer weather and with the reopening, you know, some folks are gathering, and, you know, the governor made clear that if you're at a bar or a social place and you're not doing social distancing, you could have your liquor license pulled. So, you know, there is a little bit of that, you know, carrot and stick approach, but, you know, we hope common sense prevails. And look, everything's comparative, right? You know, the president had a lot of briefings too early on, and I just don't think that what he said was consistent or had any credibility. So, and look, I heard the governor's quote, I think it was yesterday. He acknowledged, oh, there's a lot that we were learning along the way. Some mistakes were made. You know, nothing's perfect. I think what we all have learned the hard way is that we need to do a much better job in terms of resources and priority on the public health system, which, frankly, is not really a unified system, right? You have county health departments, you have hospitals, some are public, some are private. But hopefully what comes out of this is a greater sense of coordination, whether that be a self-coordination by the different healthcare entities or, in fact, more of a direct government role in achieving that. Because, look, everyone is expecting in the fall, you know, flu season comes in. There could be a second wave, as the governor has said, and all the healthcare experts said, Dr. Fauci and so on. We're not out of this yet. So until there's a vaccine, until there are more proven therapeutics, this is going to be a very challenging next few months. We're probably, you know, not until 2021 before a vaccine comes online. And until that happens, we're still going to be learning as we go.
Mr. Comptroller, when I was a young reporter in Rochester, I had to do some work on, boy, it was a case, I can't even remember all the details now, but I remember what a colleague of mine, a veteran reporter in the newsroom, said, you know, you're going to be, you know, talking to the New York State Comptroller, this is almost two decades ago, and she said, this is a position that is really, really important, and yet it's a made-up word that most people don't even know what it does. So before we talk,
don't pronounce it either, whether it's comptroller or controller. That's always the big.
It's not really a word. Well. I mean, I don't even know what that is. But before we talk about investment, divestment, climate action, sure. Why don't you explain to listeners what you spend the bulk of your time doing and how you see your role.
Sure, sure. And I'll do it briefly. You know, just keep in mind, the job of controller in New York is really a combination of jobs that typically in other states is divided up among positions like state treasurer, state auditor, pension fund board. In New York State, we've kind of joined together going back to 1797 when the first controller was appointed. It used to be an appointed position. The role of being the auditor, looking at the state's books, the state's finances, also auditing local government school districts. We talked about that certainly in terms of Rochester in the past, as you remember. That accountability agenda as far as processing state contracts, state payments, and looking out for instances of fraud or any compromising of appropriate procedures. The payroll for the state. Also a big responsibility for us to get that at every 2 weeks. So the pension fund is another responsibility. We do the benefit administration. making sure people get their pension checks after they've earned their pension, but also do the investment side with the Common Retirement Fund to provide the money to pay for those pensions. We do some miscellaneous things, administer the state's oil spill fund to clean up instances where there's not a responsible party when there's pollution. The unclaimed funds, responsibly returning people's lost money. Commenting on state budget and state finances. We don't determine the state budget, but we analyze and we comment on state budget and fiscal trends. We offer reports on the state's economy. We have a special office for New York City that comes out of the New York City fiscal crisis that monitors what's going on there. We do audits and reports on public authorities. That's a very quick version of what we do. If it has to do with money, chances are we have a role in it. But again, we don't make law. We don't make policy. We do the longer term perspective, and we do the follow up once the governor and the legislature decide how the money is going to be spent. We then take a look to make sure it's being spent in the appropriate way.
Now, let's talk about some of what you noted in your op-ed here. And you opened your op-ed by saying that there have been calls lately for the New York State Pension Fund to divest from fossil fuel companies. First of all, what does that exactly mean in your mind, to divest from fossil fuel companies?
Well, I think what the advocates mean is that any holdings that we have that are related to the fossil fuel industry, that we would sell those stock holdings.
Okay. Is that a reasonable call?
Well, we're called upon to divest from a lot of things, and sometimes called to invest in certain things. I mean, everybody's entitled to an opinion on it. And, you know, I think in terms of the broader conversation, you know, I just think we need to step back. We're a pension fund. We're set up to invest the money that's contributed by public employees and by government employers, to invest that money so that we have the money to provide retirement security. We have 1.1 million members. Most of those are active employees, state government employees and local government employees outside of New York City, including many school district employees. And they depend on our decisions to make sure that they're going to have the money there for their pensions. About 75% of the retirement benefits that we pay out, and Evan, we're paying out now over $1 billion a month in retirement benefits, 75% of that is funded by investment return, and the balance being taxpayer dollars and a smaller amount of employee contributions. So the strength and the investment strategies that are brought to bear are a very key part of what pays for the pensions and a very key part of what we can ensure that the pension system is still sustainable from an affordability point of view, because if we don't make our mark, you know, then ultimately taxpayers end up having to foot more of the bill. So we take very seriously that investment responsibility. And as an institutional investor, we have a as a pension fund, we in essence have a perpetual horizon. We're not going to go out of business. New York State's not going to go out of business. We're always going to have employees. And because we're so large, we're the third largest public pension fund in the country, we're also in effect a universal investor. So we're invested across every sector of the economy, because much of our investing in terms of the stock, the public equities, it's done passively. It's done through index funds that, again, are broadly invested across all sectors of the economy. So that's a quick lay of the landscape. I have some more thoughts on it, but I'll see where you want to take the conversation.
Well, I want to make sure I understand something.
If I might,
hold on, Liam and Radesh. Right. I'm going to make sure you got time to jump in here. I want to make sure that there is something I do understand from the controller, though, when it comes to a decision that you might make regarding where you're investing. Is it correct or incorrect, Mr. Comptroller, then, when you talk about your responsibility to seek the best return on the investment, therefore, you know, you're not going back to the taxpayers to fill any gaps, if I have that correct, is it then therefore correct to say that if you viewed fossil fuel investments as good investments, that would be in bounds because that's part of the job that you're doing, as opposed to the idea that if fossil fuels were good investments, you wouldn't want to do that anyway because of the negative impact on climate. How do you see, you know, sort of split that difference?
Let me tackle it in a slightly different way, because, and I think this is important, again, to keep in mind. This is not Tom DiNapoli picking which stocks I want to invest
okay.
in, right? I mean, that's a personal decision, a personal choice. And although I'm trustee for the fund, we have a a professional investment staff. We have consultants and advisors that guide us. We have advisory committees of lay professionals, you know, that guide us. So there's a very established and elaborate process. But what's important as far as, you know, talking about this question of divestment, I think there's a misconception out there that we are picking stocks, you know, that we're making a bet on fossil fuel companies or on airlines or on cereal companies. That's not how we do the investment of public equities. What we do, have a small part of the portfolio where we have some of our money with what are called active managers. But, you know, in the literature on investment, there's always a big debate, but many come down of late on the side of what's called passive investing through index funds that are broadly invested in the economy with different weights based on market capitalization. And so we use those indexes, we mirror those indexes with our investment strategy. Why do we do that? Well, it's cost effective for us, because if we would be stock pickers, right, if we'd have to look at every sector and every company, we would need a staff much larger than the staff that we have, or we would need consultants spending much more money on them than we do right now. So what's worked very well for us, not just in my tenure, I mean, you know, going back 20, 30, 40 years that we've been doing this kind of investing, is to recognize that there are cycles, right? There are times in the market where certain sectors are going to do well, other sectors aren't going to do as well. The indexes will reflect that. So at different times, certain stocks will be weighted more heavily in your index. Other times, it'll be lower. You know, when I started as controller, you know, 14 years ago or so, a stock like Exxon, I think, was our number one stock. You know, now it's the tech sector. It's Apple. It's those kind of stocks now, Amazon, that are the big drivers now of our portfolio. Because why? Because their market capitalization is so high. But if you remember, after the dot-com bubble burst, back in 2000, nobody was doing tech. Everybody was running away from it. Well, if we had pulled out of tech because they were performing so poorly back then, we wouldn't have gotten the upswing that's happening now. So it's not that, you know, when we talk about this issue, we are not making a bet on fossil fuel companies. We are looking at the indexes. We're seeing how energy is weighted. We're seeing what companies are performing in the energy sector. And then that's how we end up investing in some of these companies. So we're not making a bet on fossil fuels. Now, that being said, you know, we're not totally unmindful of the fact that there may be times where we need to deviate from the index. When we deviate from the index, though, that has to be part of not a political process, but a thoughtful investment process where we do an economic analysis. We get sign-off from fiduciary counsel that if we are deviating from what is our standard practice, we're not going to do anything to harm the fund. So with the example of fossil fuels and the climate issue, we've had a long history of taking leadership in terms of assessing not just environment, but also social and governance issues. We have a particular priority on dealing with the climate issue. And so after a thoughtful analysis, that's how we got to that first part of the equation that we've been looking at, which is the thermal coal companies. We ended up making a decision that we don't think will harm our fund or throw our indexes off of divesting from those 22 thermal coal companies.
Well, I think, though, I think what activists are, and probably what Radesh and Liam are going to want to talk to you about is that I think that they do feel that new forms of energy, clean energy, is a good bet to the extent that we're going to talk about a bet or a good look at has a lot of growth upside. But at the same time, even when I read your op-ed about why the fund divested from 22 coal mining companies, it's because, quote, they are not prepared to thrive or even survive in the low carbon economy. And I think people in favor of climate action would probably say, well, who cares if they're prepared to thrive or survive in a Trump administration that could go another 4 years or whatever the case may be? It's not the right thing to do. Get the money out of there. It sounds like the first consideration is just where you see the upside, not necessarily, you know, is this form of energy a problem?
Well, let me give a quick reaction, then we'll let our youth leaders come in, too.
Yeah.
But you know, again, keep in mind we're a pension fund, right? So we're looking at this. You know, ultimately, our decisions have to be based on an investment choice, right? So I mean, you have to always keep that in mind. It's what we call our fiduciary responsibility. And if you look at the broader issue of how we're going to deal with this, and you know, my hope is the Trump administration will not be around much longer. And I totally reject, you know, their position as far as Paris, because the Paris Agreement is really the global community coming together and saying this is an urgent issue and we all have to respond. But are all of us responding requires changes in government policy and regulation. And unfortunately, it's another area where Trump is rolling back important environmental protections. We need to fight against that, speak out against it. And every sector of our economy, it's climate, the risk of climate change, the greenhouse gas emissions, controlling them and reducing them is not simply a question of selling stock in fossil fuel companies. You have, really, I mean, every entity, organization has a carbon footprint. We all must be part of that conversation. It's not just fossil fuel companies. It's transportation. It's utilities. It's agriculture. I mean, you go down the long list. And what we, you know, the point we're trying to make is that we need to embrace the goals of the Paris Agreement. And we need to be looking at companies, and we're starting obviously, you know, with the energy sector, that understand that we need to deal with climate risk, global warming, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and we need to have a plan to transition to that low carbon economy. And I think we also have to recognize that energy is not going to go away as an important resource. And many of the companies that today may be having some of their operations involved with fossil fuels, they, particularly European energy companies, they're actually providing leadership to go into renewables. Why? They don't want to go out of business, right? And they have the science and the technology. So you see many of the European energy companies going into wind, going into solar, doing more in hydro. Unfortunately, the U.S. companies, frankly, are laggards in this regard. And so part of our strategy on this is to say, because again, we want to be invested for the long term. If companies understand the imperative of dealing with the climate issue and are willing to be part of that transition to the green economy, to the lower carbon economy, well, we're willing to stay with you. And we're going to press companies, especially those that don't seem to get it, that they need to get on board with this. So the notion of engagement with corporations, and we've gotten some significant agreements on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. First of all, monitoring those emissions. We've come up with some new investment strategies. Our low carbon emission index, which is an index fund strategy that rewards companies that are reducing greenhouse gas emissions. There's a lot of complexities to how we as a society are going to get to that low carbon future that we all want. And we would prefer to be invested in companies that embrace that future as well.
All right, Liam Smith, go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, so I just want to push back on several things that the controller mentioned. First of all, he mentions, you know, the pension system needs to be very careful in how it invests its money and how it diversifies its assets. And I want to push back on that because, yes, it's important to remain diversified, but the pension fund has a history of divesting when necessary to protect its pensioners and to protect, the world from poor business practices. In fact, DiNapoli himself divested from companies involved in Iran and Sudan divested completely from private prisons during his tenure. Additionally, regarding the, you know, financial risk of fossil fuel companies, a study from 2018 by a company called Corporate Knights found that the pension fund would actually be $22 billion better off if it had divested in 2008. That comes out to almost $20,000 per fund beneficiary. And so divestment would not only be the morally responsible thing to do, it would be the financially responsible thing to do. We cannot afford to allow our public pensioners to suffer because of, you know, intransigence on this issue, and we cannot afford to let my generation suffer from the impacts that climate change that result directly from this kind of intransigence.
All right, let me let the controller respond to that, and then we'll come back to it. Go ahead, Mr. DiNapoli.
Well, I don't think we're very entrenched in it at all. We're in fact moving. We're the first pension fund to have an actual plan to deal with this issue. It's important, Liam, not only for your generation, but for all generations. And you're right. You know, you and I are on the same page. When it's appropriate, we will do a divestment. And we've done that with thermal coal. We've done it with some of those other areas you mentioned. But that only came after a careful analysis. You know, Corporate Knights is basically an advocacy group. There are other groups that are pro oil and gas companies. They produce reports that say how much money we would lose if we divest. I think the reality is if we try to base our judgment on what those who have a position are saying that they recommend, it's not exactly objective information.
Go ahead, Liam. Riddish, go ahead.
Apologies. Yeah. So, Comptroller, if I might add, would you say that the, you know, financial decisions of New York City, the country of Ireland, the World Council of Churches, the Guardian, Cornell University, Brown University, the University of California system, and over 1,000 institutions representing $14 trillion of combined assets, all of these institutions have committed to divesting. Do you really think that all of these groups are making poor investment decisions or making investment decisions purely based on a political agenda and are not looking at the fact that over the last 5 years, over the last 3 years, and over the last one-year horizons, the fossil fuel industry has continually underperformed the market average? Would you say that their financial analysis is wrong in that regard?
I would say they have different needs. Other than New York City, none of what you've mentioned are, you know, our pension funds, which have a very defined obligation in terms of having to get a return to meet a pension requirement for retirees. You know, if you're investing with a family fund or even an endowment, you know, if you make less money, well, maybe you have less money to do certain things with. We have a very clear goal of trying to stay well-funded. That's why, you know, in the latest Pew Center rankings, we're 98% funded. We're doing something right with our investment strategy. You mentioned New York City. New York City has indicated that they're studying divestment. They have not divested yet. Everybody likes to point to New York City. If we've been losing money, they've been losing money also because they haven't divested yet. There is no state plan in the United States that has done the kind of divestment that's being talked about. And I think, you know, many have been very unfair, generally, in a sense, stigmatizing pension funds like we're the cause of climate change or we're going to be the solution if we sell our stock. You know, if we sell our stock, someone else is going to buy it. And in New York State, you've got five city plans. Three of them have said that they're studying divestment with a goal of doing it. Two of them have taken a different position. You have the state teachers plan, which nobody seems to talk about, and they haven't made any judgment on it.
This notion
that our state plan is somehow an outlier on this, it's just the opposite. And that's why I wrote the op-ed. We actually have been taking the lead on this. We understand that there are some instances where we should divest, but we're only going to do it as part of a coordinated plan. The Climate Action Plan came out of a group of experts that specifically said just wholesale divesting is not the solution to the climate risk to the portfolio. You need to have a more thoughtful strategy. We're actually on the same page on this. We just have, I think, a more deliberate approach in terms of how we're going to implement it.
All right, Riddish, go ahead.
So, again, just in terms of, I think we're both on the agreement that, you know, climate change is real. Is that assumption correct, Mr. Comptroller?
It is for me. I hope it is for you.
Yes, definitely. I would hope that, obviously... You know, the pandemic has shown us that, you know, science is important and believing in science is pivotal, not only in combating the coronavirus pandemic, but also combating the climate crisis. And the fact of the matter is, you know, 97% of climate scientists and climatologists agree that climate change is real and it is a human-induced phenomenon, which has been directly driven by the fossil fuel industry, who have spent millions upon millions of dollars trying to discredit this specific scientific consensus surrounding climate change. And the fact that our public monies continue to be invested and propping up the fossil fuel industry, which continues to pollute our air and our water and threatens our generation and future generations to come, it simply is not only unethical, but also directly goes against the laws mandated by New York State legislation. For example, the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act was passed just this past year and mandates that our state achieve carbon neutrality by 2050. That simply cannot be done when our state's largest pension fund is financing the same companies that will continue to release greenhouse gas emissions and prevent us from reaching this lofty goal.
Radesh, I have to ask you that. The controller is saying if they simply sold those stocks, somebody else would buy it. That doesn't magically solve that problem, is what the controller is saying.
Now, let me butt in there. The idea behind divestment is not that by selling the stock, we're magically going to see no more fossil fuel companies. The idea is that divestment, you know, as we saw with in ending apartheid, increases the visibility of the moral and financial risks faced by the fossil fuel industry. And the idea is that by divesting, you know, we undermine the industry's social license to operate. We make it more difficult for companies to, you know, obtain customers, hire new employees, and conduct business in general, because the public realizes that this industry is really, it's really doing something terrible for our future, which it is. I mean, we're talking about my future, Radesh's future, my generation's future. And one other thing I want to say is that even funds built on oil wealth have realized that fossil fuel investments no longer make financial and moral sense. The heirs to the Rockefeller oil fortune have dumped false fossil fuel stocks and found that it actually improved their bottom line. And Norway's sovereign wealth fund, which is its public pension system and is valued at over $1 trillion, it is divesting its assets from most fossil fuel stocks.
Well, let me just jump in, Liam.
That fund was actually established in 1990 to invest the company's excess petroleum revenue.
I got to give the controller the last 30 seconds if he wants to respond to that, and I appreciate all of you for being here. Controller, go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's a great conversation. I admire Liam and Radesh for their advocacy. Some of their points are not correct. In fact, Norway's situation is not quite as you described and has changed. Look, the bottom line is people have to start, you know, not having cars that use gasoline, cooking with oil, not going on a public transportation that uses natural gas. I mean, this is why these companies are still in business. We need big societal changes. To put it all on the pension funds, misplaced priority. We are actually on the same side in trying to deal with this issue. We have a bigger agenda, and a lot of it relates to Washington that we all need to be focused on.
And Mr. Comptroller, I know your op-ed talked about investments, not just divestments, but investments.
Yep.
And on a separate program, we'll talk about that. And I hope we can come back and talk about where the investments are. Comptroller Tom DiNapoli, thanks for the time, sir.
Thank you, Evan. Thank you, guys.
Radesh Singh and Liam Smith, I know there's disagreement, but thank you for being here to ask the questions, and let's come back and talk soon.
Sounds good. Thank you
for having
us.
All right, more connections coming up.